Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
starting again the next day on this seventh chapter of, or episode of, The Great Scientists. We've had a bit of a rocky ride through here, a bit of a skim of what Marie Curie was, sort of an interesting aspect of it, but I didn't get into sort of the wacky mystic side of it. On the wacky mystic side of science, it was at a time where classical science was going, but you had these phenomena of these minerals giving out energy. You know, the energy has to come in from somewhere. That they just were full on mystic people. And this is Rutherford, who's a Kiwi, but no, he did a lot of his work in Manchester. So I don't know how this goes up. And his main thing he was looking at was the fact that the particles, the alpha particles going through a gas, only just blurred the beam. If it was in a vacuum, it was a really sharp image, but as it went through a gas, it was a blurring it. And it's also interesting that he basically had the electronics. He sort of stumbled into short time period measurement electronics, which meant that he could really do these types of things. So, in 1902, Rutherford and Soddy concluded that radioactivity was a process in which atoms of one element spontaneously changed to atoms of a different element, which were also radioactive. Okay, so this is interesting. So they just observed physically atoms in a tube changing. Until this time, scientists were firmly believed that atoms were unchanging blocks of nature. The idea of the atom could be ripped themselves apart and changed into different kinds of atoms, in other words, that one element could change to another, mocked, smacked of medieval alchemy, and was firmly resisted by many chemists. Despite the controversial nature of his discoveries, Rutherford was elected to the Royal Society in 1903 and awarded the Rutherford Medal in 1904 for recognition of his achievements. In 1908, a further experimentation proved correctness of Rutherford's and Soddy's conclusion. Rutherford was awarded the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. So it's interesting that before he discovered the nucleus, he was awarded the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. The theory of the atom, the years before that, he had returned to England to take professorship of the University of Manchester. Okay, that's that makes sense. Here he continued to research an alpha rays known to be composed of particles. But his assistant George, he and his assistant Hans Geiger, constructed a mechanism that allowed them to count particles one by one as they emerged from a known quantity of radium. Now, this is interesting. That I think Geiger came to ask him a question and stayed. By measuring the total charge collected, they were able to deduce the alpha particles were positively charged. That's correct. In 1908, Rutherford allowed alpha particles to pass through a thin glass wall of a container to the outer glass tube and found that the gas collected was helium, thereby proving alpha particles were in fact ionized elements of helium, or helium atoms stripped from their electrons. Isn't that amazing? I didn't know that bit. So there's all birds and things like this. While he was at McGill, Rutherford had experimented with firing alpha particles into photographic plates. He noted that while the image produced was sharp, if he passed the alpha particles through marker, the resulting image of the photographic plate was diffuse. The particles were clearly being deflected at small angles as they passed close to the atoms of mica. In 1911, Rutherford repeated the experiment, this time with a sheet of gold. He suggested to his assistant Hansen, Geiger, and Marsden that it would be interesting to check whether any particles were scattered backwards. I think this is incorrect. I think he was more about getting the precise distribution, the scattering profile, which showed it was a one on z squared field. That is, deflected through angles more than 90 degrees. To their astonishment, they discovered a small portion of particles did indeed scatter from more than 90 degrees, emerging at the same side of the gold foil as they entered. Rutherford described the latter as quite incredible event that happened to me in my life. It's almost as if you had fired a 15-inch shell at a piece of tissue paper and it came back and hit you. I suppose that's the major thing. It's just that there are parts of the atom which are obviously small and can bounce that exchange momentum. After doing some calculations, Rutherford concluded that the powerful positive charge at the heart of the atom could have caused the positively charged particles to be deflected so dramatically. And because only one about 8,000 bounced back, the nucleus was approximately 8,000 times smaller than the entire atom, which is more or less, this is 8,000 times smaller in terms of cross-sectional area. Now, this doesn't mean volume, okay? This is 8,000 is if you're going to paint take a two-dimensional photograph. So this is only in two dimensions, not in three dimension. And even worse, and this is the potential size of it, because this is a very sort of the hard sphere scattering approximation. So hard sphere scattering approximation produces a uniform distribution to, if it hits, it's, will have a flat distribution as angle, but it wasn't a hard sphere, it was a inverse square potential, so it means that a lot more particles got slightly deflected and a few got fully deflected, whereas if you've got a hard sphere, you've got a uniform flat, distribution, so that was there. 8,000, because it's two-dimensional, 8,000, 1 in 8,000, if you could do that, is the square root of that. And so the square root of 1,000 is roughly 30, and the square root of 8 is 2, and the square root 2 times 1.43, it's about 90. So that is just bizarrely incorrect. I don't know whether he actually said that. The rest of the atom must be empty space, allowing... Is this a quote from him? I don't think he said it was empty space. Allowing the particles to pass through. Oh, this is a misconception, because in quantum mechanics, it is effectively empty space, but it is space which can be filled in other dimensions. So the dimensions that the helium go through are empty, the particles go through are empty, but that space is occupied in other dimensions, quantum mechanical dimensions of the electron, so it doesn't interact with the electron. The positive charge of the nucleus was clearly balanced by the equal negative charge of electrons distributed around it. Rutherford's theory of the structure of the atom was not wholly new. In 1904, a Japanese physicist, Hantanaro, this is a very interesting piece of history, Nagazawa proposed a model of electrons rotating around a central nucleus. But Nagazawa's model had been rejected because, according to classical physics, the orbiting electrons would almost immediately lose their energy and fall into the nucleus. And it is still rejected. And Rutherford is still rejected. You've got to understand that. Right now, however, Rutherford had proved the experimental evidence that Nagazawa might have been right after all. In 1913, the Danish physicist Niels Bohr showed that electrons, contrary to classical laws of physics, do not lose their energy during rotation. No, he did not show that. That is absolute. He used his personality to assert that was true. He didn't show it. Certain well-defined orbits around, confirming Rutherford and Nagazawa. Well, he just had sufficient personality to push something that everyone was skeptical was against and was later proved incorrect. This theory of the structure of the atom is known as the Rutherford atomic model. Oh dear. Protons and neutrons. Rutherford received the knighthood in 1914 at age 43 in recognition of his many achievements. But he was not a man to rest on his laurels. During the First World War, he developed a system for detecting submarines by underwater acoustics. In 1919, he became the first person to disintegrate an atom artificially by causing it to collide with an alpha particle. That is splatterate. So he actually bombarded it. By this means, he managed to change a nitrogen atom into a hydrogen atom and a hydrogen. He had transformation. The following year, Rutherford worked out that the collision had caused the possibly charged particles to eject from the nucleus. That's changed the nature of the atom. He named the particles protons. That's interesting. And he then speculated how positively charged protons could coexist with neutrons without blowing themselves the rest apart. He suggested that protons might be balanced by some neutral charged particles, which are called neutrons. the existence of neutrons was proven by James Chadwick, Cavendish Laboratory. James Chadwick was basically some sort of autistic person. He was so shy that he was going to become an accountant, but took a wrong turn at Cambridge, and then convinced him to have a go at physics. In 1911, Rutherford succeeded J.J. Johnson as the head of the Cavendish Laboratory at Cambridge. In this role, Rutherford had less of an experimental time for experimental research, but continued to give lectures in support of his students. During his later years, Rutherford was a recipient of many medals, awards, and honorary doctorates. He died at Cambridge in 1937, aged 66. His ashes were burned in the nave. Is buried in the nave of Westminster Abbey. Ernest Rutherford was fortunate in many ways to have been alive at a time when so many discoveries were being made in physics and chemistry. But what is interesting from his colleagues, and the reason why he's remembered today, is one of the great experimental physicists of all time. I would say so. This is the key to getting time. And I don't think people nowadays understand the importance of timing electronics, you know, good timing electronics and good power supplies. And you can sort of buy this for $11 and $12, you know, ridiculously small things. You can get these fantastic microsecond precision electronics for nothing. You know, they just come with it. It's just eye-watering to see how good the electronics is nowadays. But he managed to have it there. Rutherford was an extremely stubborn and patient man, willing to work problems far longer than most. He was also blessed with an open mind and was willing to entertain and speculate possibilities more traditionally minded scientists had rejected. As a student of James Chadwick's, James Chadwick said, Rutherford's ultimate distinction was his genius to be astonished. I can be astonished. Okay, I do like that. And it does really say that we've got all these glamour celebrity scientists, but we've really got to dig into these tormented, spiritual, stubborn, autistic. You've got all these different scientists, and we've got this Einstein coming up over everybody. Discovering the half-life, this is a quart A little box. During their experiments of radioactive elements in 1901 to 1903, Rutherford and Frederick Soderick found that these substances decayed at regular rates. It always took the same amount of time for half the atoms of the sample to decay. For example, if half the thorium sample decayed in 4 days, then half the remaining would decay over the next following 4 days, and so on. Rutherford saw a practical use for this. He realized that half-life was a steady rate of decay, could be used as a means of measuring the age of a piece of rock. In order to work out how old rock was, it was only necessary to measure the amount of radiation it contained and how swiftly it was decaying. He tested a piece of pitchblende, a mineral containing uranium, and found it to be 700 million years old, proving the Earth is far older than most experts at the time believed. As a byproduct of his work, Rutherford made a significant discovery of an entirely different field and pioneered a new scientist of radioactive dating. Okay, well, into this one, it's Curie, Rutherford, and Albert Einstein. In 1905, a paper published in the German scientific journal describing special theory of relativity. Now, there were three papers. The implications of the theory are so profound that it would overturn classical physics to transform its scientific view of such things as space, time, matter, light, energy and light. He just applied Lorentzian dynamics to the let's read it. One of the great thing about Einstein is that he was able to entertain many theories and let them rain down. He described sort of emergence between experimental thought and rational thought of Kant. So this is where you can work things out purely by, is it logical? And then he wrote this beautiful passage, which I cannot find, unfortunately. The author of the paper was a 26-year-old clerk at the Swiss Patent Office named Albert Einstein, 1879 to 1955. And I think he had this heart condition, and he decided he basically committed suicide. It was the most incredible thing. He said, my aorta's gone, I have no more work to do. And he was a very isolated man, And when you read it, really read about it, you can see the isolation of him. Einstein held no university post and had no access to a laboratory for academic library. His ideas seemed to come out of nowhere. Well, gee whiz. As a physicist C.P. Snow had written, it has as if he had researched, reached the conclusions by pure thought, unaided. Well, this is true. 10 years later, Einstein competed this one-man scientific revolution in his general theory of relativity, which offered a new explanation for the gravity. Physics would never be the same again. That is true, but the ideas did come out of nowhere. They came out of rationalism. And these experimenters cannot understand this. This is your average scientist and teacher does not read back to Leibniz and Kant and stuff like that. And they don't understand that he was in the traditional of a German, of the German rational school. He just applied it systematically. Early life. Albert Einstein was born in Ulm, Germany, in 14th of March 1976 and grew up in Munich. Now, so because he was born in Ulm, it's Schwabia, which is sort of like the yokel part of Germany. It's sort of, they were, like every country, like the British Empire have Ireland, which the Irish are a bit foolish, the French have, the Spanish have a certain group. You all have certain groups, and for Germany, if you have this Schwabian accent, it's sort of like a country in Western accent, I understand. It is said that he did not learn to speak until he was three. So for me, I learnt about the same time, but I wasn't understood until I was 7 years old myself. The young Albert hated school, and tough discipline, rigid teaching models showed little academic promise. His only pleasures were the violin that he would play all his life, and mathematics. He left school without at 15 without a diploma. There's other things there that there's a whole lot of things going in his life besides that. Well, it's about. To avoid military conscription, Einstein gave up German citizenship and moved to Switzerland. In Zurich, he succeeded in gaining a place on the second attempt in the Polytechnic to study physics and mathematics. On graduating in 1900, Einstein began working as a temporary mathematics teacher, but hoped. So these are teachers, right? Who hoped to get the university to continue his studies. He applied for an entrance of several institutions in 1900 to 1901 without success. In 1902, he got a job at the technical examiner of third class in the patent office in Berlin, so this would be a very low-grade clerk. The job gave him sufficient financial security, married a Hungarian fiancé, Maliva Marik. It also followed him allowed him some spare time, which he spent exercising what he described the disposition of abstract mathematical thought. He began contributing papers to the German Physics Journal, Annals of Physics. Now, what I do want to say is that his abstract thought was not the actual mathematics. So he wasn't actually very good at the actual mathematics. He was at the conceptualization of mathematics, and people who actually ground through and proved he was right, he said, were clever hands. People, there was a horse at the time that was able to clock, hit the hooves. It turned out that it was reading the signals of a far greater ignorance, of far greater intellect of the trainer. It was giving little heats. So you'd say, hands, what is 2 plus 3? And the horse would clock 5 times to give the answer. Now, and what would happen is that the horse would be knowing what to do because he didn't have a deep understanding of what's going on. Miracle year, in 1905, Einstein seemed to find a new level of creativity. He submitted 5 papers to the Annals that year, all remarkable insights to a piece of work. One of them is truly historic. I think they're all truly historic. I don't know what the 5 papers were. There was the Brownian motion, the photoelectric effect, capillary, and special relativity. I really don't understand. In the first place, offered an explanation of the photoelectric effect, see box on page 26. In 1921, he would receive the Nobel Prize for this paper. And it was really curious that there was an American person called Milgram, who was a racist and tried to disprove Einstein and wound up that he was proving him right. So he hated Einstein, got a Nobel Prize for proving Einstein right. Amazing, beautiful piece. The second paper was about measuring the size of molecules. For this, it was awarded the doctorate at the Zurich Polytechnic. The third proved the theoretical explanation of Brownian motion. Ah, okay, so those are two separate papers. The movement of tiny particles. Einstein used mathematical calculations to prove the particles jiggle about as they do because the molecules in liquids are in motion due to heat energy with colliding particles. This paper is important, providing further evidence for the existence of the atom. In fact, it was the conclusive bit for the existence of the atom. Unfortunately, Boltzmann didn't get it in time and committed suicide. So this is one of the things that we're reading here, this book's not going too much more. There's not too many great scientists after Einstein. Well, there you go. I wonder if Feynman's in here. Einstein's fourth paper, 1905, The Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies, was his most significant. It outlined the special theory, and this is the most important thing, is that in this first paper, he proved that light and was frame independent, yet electricity and magnetism were interchangeable depending on your frame. It's pretty amazing. He proposed that space and time are relative to the observer. In other words, the only reason why we experience time in the same way is that because we are all moving at the same speed relative to each other. When observers move at different speeds, strange things start to happen. For example, someone on Earth observing a passing spaceship traveling, so it's VO. I'm just trying to think. I've got to really go back to those equations because the VO is the occupant of the frame. So the occupant of the frame is the proper time, if you occupant the frame. And the V, rather than velocity, is viewer. I think that's a better way of doing it, going back through it. If the Earthbound observer would measure the space ship's mass, he would find that it had become heavier. This is true. And if he did see the clock in the spaceship, he would notice that it was going slower. Yet an astronaut on the ship, everything in the length of mass in the ship would progress. The rocket at the time would appear normal. Okay, which very poorly explained. The subtle implication of this theory was there's no such thing as absolute space and time. They depended on the position and speed of the object experienced them. No, I think just purely on the speed, mate. This had not been noticed before because the slow speeds of our normal lives and the laws of classical physics, which say space and time are absolute and appear correct. That's one aspect, and then you go the next step back, you get angel time from the Middle Ages. It's really complex to say that classical physics is not standing up. It was propped up, and it has inside it angelic. It's got nonsense. It's nonsensical. It's stupid. The only absolute, according to Einstein, was the speed of light, which was the same however we measured it. Well, yeah, I suppose. So what was it? The laws of physics are true for all inertial frames, and the speed of light is the same for all inertial frames. And so an inertial frame is where the laws of Newton work. That sort of frame is where the laws of Newton work. So that's rather cute. E equals MC squared. Vomit. They've written E equals MC squared with a big M and a capital C. And of course, you're not allowed to do that. And, there's an equation which will add. Soon after Einstein was sent his paper, he saw a further implication of theory and immediately set to work on a fifth paper. That's the fifth paper. Einstein had already stated, as the vehicle approaches the speed of light, it maths increases. To achieve this increase, energy needed to push the vehicle faster. In other words, the energy has been turned into mass. Isn't that beautiful? And Einstein therefore concluded that the mass was simply the energy in a different form. He derived the famous formula equals mc squared. Oh, yuck, surely an editor could have got in case of that. Energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. Well, he had c equals 1 equals m, g equals t. It all resolves to that. I think he had a different thing. This is a completely new idea, among other things, that explained how radiation worked. And so when you really get into it, if energy is light, light is matter, which is true, that if you get matter and antimatter, you get light at the end of it. And space untwiggles and loses its mass. That is, you can summon into existence hypercharge, which happens in the Higgs boson. Look, she was, there's my memory going. Higgs boson. There you go. My memory's coming back a bit. Einstein's theories, B equals MC squared also implied there's a lot of potential energy contained within every atom. No, not necessarily. That's upsetting for me to read that. Einstein's theories did not attract much attention at first, as the humble patent office clerk, even one with a doctorate, he lacked the status of the scientific community. Also, his theories were so revolutionary and strange that the equations used to reach them, so complicated. That's... What? I think... Why... I would doubt that they were complicated. It's likely that many scientists did not fully understand them, or else rejected the work as a crank. I don't know where they say that. It's just that it's a big scientific world now, and it's hard for information to get across cultures and stuff like that. Einstein's ideas began to circulate in 1907. As Einstein's reputation grew, he began looking for a university post that could continue his research. 2 years later, he was offered a professor of theoretical physics at Zurich Polytechnic and was able to resign for a job at the patent office. He spent a brief time in the German University of Prague, where he was awarded a full professorship before returning to Zurich Polytechnic in 1912. At the end of 1913, he was persuaded by Max Planck to join him as a professor in Berlin University, where Einstein was free to continue research with only very light lecturing duties. General theory of relativity. This suited Einstein, who was engaged in extension of the special relativity of gravity. And the critical thing is that everyone is looking at the mass and the effects of gravity. You've really got to look at space and how you handle space, and you say space is a field of numbers, and those numbers get successively more complicated. They go from scalar to vector to tensor numbers. It's a tensor field equation. That's all the maths is. There's nothing complicated about it. This suited Einstein, who's engaged in... special relativity was so called because it only worked for objects that moved at a steady velocity, but not for objects which change speed and direction because of gravity. Therefore, your twin paradox is simply explained the paradox of special relativity, in that when you say the twin accelerates away and accelerates back, the two twins have not had the same time. They have had non-identical acceleration, where the twin had artificial gravity applied on them, and therefore their clock slowed down. It's interesting how it goes through. Einstein eventually submitted the general theory of relativity in 1915, a paper which is quite remarkable, as a theory 10 years earlier. It said that gravity is not a force, as physicists believe since Newton. Therefore, the lines of force are not true. Therefore, Faraday is incorrect. Maxwell was on the money. And really, Einstein was just unpacking Maxwell to start off with. By space-time, Einstein meant that space and time, which we regard as separate things, are actually one of the four-dimensional continuum. Blah. Well, yeah, so your tensor field is a four-dimensional tensor field. Three of these dimensions are the directions through space, and the fourth dimension is through time. According to Einstein's general theory, objects' mass creates distortion and curvature in space-time, and the larger the object, the greater the distortion. Well, yes, distortions, or they have a tense, it has a create, what would you call it? Distortion, you'd call it tense, it has a tensor value. Planets orbit the sun not because they are impelled by a force, but because the sun has curved space-time, causing the planets to follow an elliptical line through space. Or, no, planets travel in a space straight line, except that straight line is now curved. Bucko. Most people found Einstein's laser theory hard to fathom, and those few who could understand it rejected it as absurd. Einstein would need to prove some physical proof, either Sibley or Eddington, for the world would really accept the general theory. The proof came a few years later. Einstein said that everything would be affected by distortions in even light. His theory was therefore proof correct if he could show that the light from a star viewed from Earth was bent as it passed through the sun. The only time stars can be seen in daylight is during a solar eclipse. In 29th of May 2019, astronomer Arthur Eddington went to Guinea on Africa to observe the eclipse, and this is such a beautiful story, I love it. In November, the Royal Society of London announced that one of Eddington's photographs showed the stars whose light passed very close to the sun appeared to shift position. The shift was almost exactly as Einstein had predicted. I love the way that they presented. This is just, it was just so good. The most famous scientist in the world, it's true. And it's interesting that the West's idea of celebrity was bolted onto the scientists rather than the scientists bolted onto the celebrity. The announcements made headlines, and Einstein quickly became the world's most best-known scientist. He was deluged with letters and requests by articles inviting us to give lectures. Somewhat disturbed and embarrassed by all this acclaim, Einstein kept working. His next project was to try and find a link between electromagnetism and gravity. This was to be the first stage of a grand plan to discover the grand unifying theory, a theory that could explain the laws that govern everything in the universe, the subatomic particles, the stars and planets. The quest, which was to dominate the rest of Einstein's life, was destined to fail. It failed. I don't think you say it was destined to fail. The new physics of quantum theory, which Einstein himself had helped establish, showed uncertainty principle govern some math can only predict with the I'll read this to you, but it makes me vomit. The new physics of quantum theory, which Einstein himself helped establish, showed that the uncertainty principle governed the subatomic particles. Mathematics can only predict where a particle probably is, not exactly where it is, which is just complete bollocks. Einstein recognized the validity of some aspects of quantum theory, but he could never accept the uncertainty principle, nor the probability, which means that solving problems in physics, as he said, God does not play dice with the universe. And it is true that the theory, as presented by this breakaway cult, was just laughable. When Einstein published the first version of his unified theory in 1929, he received a lot of attention by the world's press, but fellow scientists were critical. They claimed Einstein was heading in the wrong direction, and which he would go to devote his efforts to helping them with quantum theory. In 1920s, Einstein became increasingly involved in political causes. A lifelong pacifist, he became an active campaigner for the cause. He travelled widely and corresponded with famous figures as physicists, psychiatrist Sigmund Freud, and Hindu poet and mystic Ranabidhi Tagore. Well, that's news to me. In 1913, he accepted a post at the Institute of Advanced Study in Princeton. It's 1933. I think the Nazis were taking his boat and giving it to the Hitler Youth. Might have pushed them away. The new Institute of Advanced Studies in Princeton, New Jersey, USA. Now, New Jersey, I have to tell you, is a bit of a toilet of a place. And it's sort of a nice place around New Jersey. I had friends at the PPL, Plasma Physics Laboratory, just an interesting place. When he published a new version of his unified theory in 1950, again it was criticized, but this time his work was largely ignored by most theoretical physicists and died in April 1955, age 76. I think the fact that he couldn't just use theory to go across here, he had the quantum field theory, not the quantum field, he had a field theory, right? He had a field theory and a tensor theory. He just was, I suppose, you know, wrongly put up people with wrong explanations hit him. And it's interesting that you've got the quantum field theory, QFT, is that next thing which allows you to add sufficient dimensions into it. Look, he just basically packed more dimensions into space. Einstein is remembered today as one of the greatest scientists who had ever lived. These theories developed in the early years of the 20th century changed our understanding of the laws of the universe. They have been proved correct through observation experiments time and time again. General relativity showed the universe expanding even though the time Einstein believed the static universe. And he was proved another astronomer, Edwin Hubble, in 1929, so they probably will cover Hubble if they're going to mention him. The equation equals mc squared had practical applications in the development of nuclear energy and found destructive power of the atomic bomb. Today, physicists are still trying to link electromagnetism to gravity and complete Einstein's unified field theory. Yeah, well, it's, I think the Higgs boson's gone a long way in that direction. I don't know, I love the Bain theory. The Bain theory, okay. The photoelectric effect. When light hits a piece of metal, electrons are dislodged from the atoms on the surface of the metal. Are they? I would say they're dislodged from the Fermi sea, but myself. Scientists knew about the photoelectric effect and had no idea how it was caused. Einstein predicted the recently developed quantum theory to the problem. Quantum theory showed that energy was emitted by radiating objects in discrete quantities. Yeah, quanta. Known as quanta. Okay. Einstein suggested that light behaved in the same way. A light beam, he said, was a stream of energy particles called photons. Photons with sufficient energy could knock out electrons from the atoms. Experiments in 1913 showed Einstein was right. I think he was commenting on effects that he'd already seen. That were already there. I don't know whether that, how correct that is. So I'll finish this off and put this off as the next item to put up on the internet. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.